mercy on me, my God. Have mercy on me, for in you I take refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed. I cry out to God Most High, to God who vindicates me. He sends from heaven and saves me, rebuking those who hotly pursue me. God sends forth his love and his faithfulness. I am in the midst of lions. I am forced to dwell among ravenous beasts, men whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp swords. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. They spread a net for my feet. I was bowed down in distress. They dug a pit in my path, but they have fallen into it themselves. My heart, O God, is steadfast. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make music. Awake, my soul. Awake, harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. I will praise you, Lord. Among the nations, I will sing of you among the peoples. For great is your love, reaching to the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the skies. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth.
I've not read the passage before about the phones in church that Eric referenced earlier. I will look for that. I can tell you that 12 years ago when I came to Northway, I had no gray hair and no children. And I thought it was four kids that did this, but apparently it's the phones in church. So I'm going to look for that passage. We do appreciate your help with this. This, you know, in a crowd this size, it's easy to forget about things that buzz and ring and make noise during church. And many times it can be right in the middle of a moment that God is speaking to people around you. And so thank you for just observing that. And let me take just a moment to welcome those who are in our overflow room, as well as those who are joining us on Facebook Live. Thank you for worshiping with us. And we appreciate those of you in here who have worshiped with us through music and now through reading God's Word. 6.5 years ago or so, I had the chance to take a sabbatical. At the time, our two oldest children were just in preschool, and so the thought of going away to some university or seminary setting for several weeks to study and to read and to write just did not seem like the thing to do. I did not want to be gone from my family that long. I did not want to leave Katie as a single parent for that long. And so instead of going away to one of those schools, I made my own study plan. I picked out several books that I would read and things I would accomplish during that time. And since it was April, it was the off season, since our kids were not in big school yet, we actually rented a place at the beach. And we spent those several weeks at the beach. I would get up in the mornings and I would read and I would write and I would study. And in the afternoons, we would go out to the beach or we would go and explore some area close to where we were staying. So this was great. For about 2.5 weeks, everything went great. And then the last week we were there, everything changed. This sudden storm came in, this cold front came in, all of these winds came in, and just for days and days, it rained and it was cold and the wind was just howling and we were stuck inside this house. The storm just would not go away and we were stuck there. We were unable to go out to the beach. We were unable to go outside to do much of anything. We were just stuck inside the house. Now, if you're a parent, you understand what it's like to be stuck inside a house with a couple of preschoolers. It's no fun at all. And at some point, I looked at Katie and said, I think I would rather be at work right now than on sabbatical because this is driving me crazy. And I didn't know what she would say. And she looked at me and said, you know, if we were back in Macon, these kids could go to preschool and we'd have a little relief from this. And I said, you know, you're right. And so even though we had several days left of the house, we packed our bags and the next morning we headed out. We were just tired of it. And all of that sent us home because of this storm that would not go away. I think sometimes in life we have these experiences where we feel like there is a storm we are going through and it will not leave us. The rain just keeps coming. The winds just keep hitting us. The clouds just hang over our lives and it won't go away. What do we do when we face these times that we feel like we just cannot get any relief from the storm? That's what we're going to look at today as we look at Psalm 57. You heard this psalm read earlier on the video. Psalm 57 was written by David, the second king over Israel, the individual who wrote about half of the Psalms. This psalm was written during a specific event in his life. If you've got a Bible with you and you want to turn to 1 Samuel 24, we will read several verses in that chapter about this event that happened in David's life and the occasion when he wrote this psalm. Let me give you just a little bit of background before we read these verses. About 3,000 years ago, about 1,000 years before Jesus came, the king over Israel was a guy named Saul. Saul was the first king over Israel. In fact, before Saul, Israel did not have kings. They had these judges who ruled. But then the people in Israel, they looked at the nations around them and said, hey, all those nations have kings, and we would like to have a king like all those other nations. And God said, you really don't want a king? And they said, we do. And God said, are you sure? And they said, we really want a king. So God said, fine. And Saul was anointed by God as the first king over Israel. And he started off great. Saul fit the picture of a king. He was tall, he was handsome, he was this great warrior. He defeated their enemies, he was following after God. Everything started off great. Then Saul's heart drifted from God. Drifted so far, in fact, that God said, that's it, I'm done with Saul, we need a new king. And so God went outside of Saul's family and anointed a guy named David as king. Even though David was anointed as king, it would be about 10 years before he would actually become king. Saul knew that this had happened. Saul was not happy about it. Saul wanted to remain king himself, or when he was dead, to have his son or one of his sons become king. And so Saul spent a lot of time pursuing and trying to kill David so that the kingship could stay in Saul's house. So, with that as a background, 1 Samuel 24, and we'll begin with verse 1. Here's what we read. After Saul returned from pursuing the Philistines, he was told, David is in the desert of En-Gedi. So Saul took 3,000 able young men from all Israel and set out to look for David and his men near the crags of the wild goats. Okay, so if you've been in church for a while, you know that the Philistines were the sworn enemies of the Israelites. Israel was always having problems with these people called the Philistines. Before this chapter, Saul was pursuing David to kill David, and then he got word that the Philistines were causing trouble, you know, near their border, and so he had to turn and he had to go deal with the Philistines. Once that was handled, he came back to pursue David. And here the text tells us that he was pursuing David in the desert of En-Gedi. En-Gedi is located about 35 miles to the southeast of Jerusalem near the Dead Sea. To give you a little bit of perspective on this, here's a map of Israel. En-Gedi is located right here where the T is next to the Dead Sea in southern Israel. If you go to Israel, in the northern part of Israel, especially around the Sea of Galilee, there are a lot of trees, there's a lot of vegetation, it's very green. You get to southern Israel, and especially this area between Jerusalem and the Dead Sea, and it is desert. It's nothing but sandy, rocky soil. In fact, if you've ever read about Jesus getting baptized in the Jordan, the tradition is, and it's a pretty good tradition, is that it happened about here, just north of the Dead Sea. That's where Jesus was baptized in the Jordan River. If you've read that story, you know that afterwards that he went into the wilderness where he was tempted, where he fasted for 40 days, where Satan came and tried to tempt Jesus into sinning. When you read that story from our perspective, we think that Jesus was hanging out for 40 days in the woods, right? We picture like the North Georgia mountains. That's where Jesus was fasting for 40 days. No, that's not it at all. When Jesus was in the wilderness, it was the desert. In fact, this is what it looked like where Jesus was. in the wilderness. This is how they describe the wilderness. Looked like this, without the road and the cars and the satellite dishes, and I think those are solar panels, but without, you know, all of that there. In fact, Katie and I went to Israel earlier this year, and I took this picture from the top of a place called Masada. It was a fortress in the desert that King Herod had built from the top of Masada. That's all you see. For miles and miles, you see the desert and the Dead Sea where there is no life. The Dead Sea has so much salt in it, there's no life in the Dead Sea. It is just this barren land forever. Except this one spring in the desert called En Gedi. It is this natural spring in Israel. It is where the only waterfall in all of Israel is. It is this oasis in the desert. We got to visit there as well. Here we are in front of this waterfall created by this natural spring. Here's a shot where you can see the top. The water comes out. It pools into this small area here, and then a creek flows from that. En Gedi was this oasis in the desert for the people who lived back then. In fact, the name En Gedi actually means spring of the young goat. Goats, other animals would come there because that is where they could get refreshment in the desert. So Saul heard that David was hiding out at En Gedi. That makes sense. That was a good place for David to hide out. So Saul gets 3,000 men and they head to En Gedi to find David. All right, verse 3. He came to the sheep pens along the way. A cave was there, and Saul went in to relieve himself. David and his men were far back in the cave. The men said, "This is the day the Lord spoke of when he said to you, 'I will give your enemy into your hands for you to deal with as you wish.'" Then David crept up unnoticed and cut off a corner of Saul's robe. Okay, so again, get the picture. They're in En Gedi. Saul and his army of 3,000 men are approaching En Gedi. And all along the mountainside there, around this natural spring, are these caves. In fact, I took a picture of the caves that were there. You just find all these caves, hundreds and hundreds of caves around En Gedi. Saul, they're going along, and Saul, as we say in our house, had to go potty. There's a cave there. Needs a little privacy. So he goes into the cave to go potty. Out of the hundreds of caves that are dotted along the mountainside, he just happens to choose the one cave where David and his men are hiding out deeper in the cave. Saul goes in, removes his robe so he can, you know, go potty. And David's men whisper to him, "This is it. Man, this is it. You, David, can end your suffering right now. I mean, here is the cause of your suffering. This guy named King Saul, he has come into this cave. Out of all the caves he could have chosen, this cave, he has come in. God has delivered the king into your hands with your sword. You can end your suffering right now." David doesn't do it. It says that David went and he cut off a corner of Saul's robe. We'll come back to that in just a minute. Look at verse 5. "Afterward, David was conscience stricken for having cut off a corner of his robe. He said to his men, 'The Lord forbid that I should do such a thing to my master, the Lord's anointed, or lay my hand on him, for he is the anointed of the Lord.' With these words, David sharply rebuked his men and did not allow them to attack Saul. And Saul left the cave and went on his way." So David here says, I know, I could have killed Saul, but God has anointed Saul to be king over Israel, just as God has anointed me to be the next king. And even though it appears that, yes, I could end my suffering right now by taking Saul's life, that it appears that God has just delivered him into my hands, if God wants Saul out of the way, I'm going to let God deal with Saul. I'm not going to short-circuit God's plan just to end my suffering and to go ahead and become king. And so he refuses to kill Saul, but he does want Saul to know that he came pretty close to death. So look at the next verse, verse 8. "Then David went out of the cave and called out to Saul, 'My lord the king.' When Saul looked behind him, David bowed down and prostrated himself with his face to the ground. He said to Saul, "Why do you listen when men say, 'David is bent on harming you'? This day you have seen with your own eyes how the Lord delivered you into my hands in the cave. Some urged me to kill you, but I spared you. I said, 'I will not lay my hand on my Lord, because he is the Lord's anointed.'" In verse 11, "See, my father, look at this piece of your robe in my hand. I cut off the corner of your robe, but did not kill you. See that there is nothing in my hand to indicate that I am guilty of wrongdoing or rebellion. I have not wronged you, but you are hunting me down to take my life." Then skip down to 16. "When David finished saying this, Saul asked, 'Is that your voice, David, my son?' And he wept aloud. 'You are more righteous than I,' he said. 'You have treated me well, but I have treated you badly. You have just now told me about the good you did to me. The Lord delivered me into your hands, but you did not kill me.'" So here Saul recognizes, yeah, you spared my life. You've been kind to me. I've been trying to kill you. You've been kind to me. And so the text says that Saul leaves that area and he quits pursuing David for a little while. In fact, just a very short while. Saul was crazy by this point. He was crazy with jealousy. And so he once again began to pursue David. He began to try to hunt down David and to kill David. And here David could have ended his suffering, but he didn't. Okay, in this context, in this setting, is when David wrote Psalm 57. Maybe right before this event, maybe right after this event, we're not sure. But we do know this is when he wrote Psalm 57. So if you've got a Bible, Psalm 57, if you look at the very top, there are these introductory statements to the psalm. It says, Psalm 57 was written and intended to be a worship song. It says it's for the director of music. Then it says that this psalm was written to the tune of Do Not Destroy. Do Not Destroy was the name of a tune that they would sing this song to. We presume that David wrote the music to this psalm. So David wrote the words, David wrote the music. This same tune was used for four other psalms that we have. Psalm 57, which David wrote, Psalm 58, which David wrote, and Psalm 59, which David wrote. Then the fourth one is Psalm 75, which was written by a guy named Asaph. Asaph wrote the words to that psalm, but then he stole this tune from David, the music, to put to the words for his psalm. It's kind of like what Vanilla Ice did when he stole Queen's song Under Pressure for his own music. Hopefully that helps some of you put it into context. Asaph stole that song from David. Okay, so here we are, Psalm 57, beginning with verse 1. David writes, "Have mercy on me, my God. Have mercy on me, for in you I take refuge. I will take refuge in the shadow of your wings until the disaster has passed." Six times in the Psalms, David uses this metaphor of taking refuge in the shadow of your wings. He pictures God as this large bird, and during the storm, even though the storm is there, David is able to find shelter under the wings of this mighty God, under the shelter of his wings. David says, look, the storm hasn't gone, but God, you are my refuge in the storm. Then verse 2, "I cry out to God Most High, to God who vindicates me. He sends from heaven and saves me, rebuking those who hotly pursue me. God sends forth his love and his faithfulness. I am in the midst of lions. I am forced to dwell among the ravenous beasts, men whose teeth are spears and arrows, whose tongues are sharp as swords." So here David says, look, I've done no wrong. God, I am confident that you will vindicate me in this. I mean, we've talked about in this series how sometimes we suffer because God has to discipline us. We suffer because we've gotten off track and God allows suffering to basically create a course correction in our lives. Here, we know from the psalm and from the backstory, David had done no wrong. In fact, David had gone above and beyond to do right. And yet he was still suffering. And he says here, look, God, I know that I've not done wrong, and I have confidence that in the end you will vindicate me, that my enemies, these who are out to get me, that the truth will come out, and they will suffer, and I'll be vindicated. And go to verse 5. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. They spread a net for my feet. I was bowed down in distress. They dug a pit in my path, but they have fallen into it themselves. So David here pictures that time when God will vindicate him. And he says, God, when that day comes, my enemies will fall into the very pit that they dug for me. I mean, they will destroy themselves. And God, when this happens, not only will it end my suffering, but God, it will be for your glory. I mean, everyone will see that you have done this, and your name will be glorified. And go to verse 7. My heart, O God, is steadfast. My heart is steadfast. I will sing and make music. Awake, my soul. Awake, harp and lyre. I will awaken the dawn. I will praise you, Lord, among the nations. I will sing of you among the peoples, for great is your love, reaching to the heavens. Your faithfulness reaches to the skies. Be exalted, O God, above the heavens. Let your glory be over all the earth. So here David says, look, I am confident, God, that you will rescue me. But even though I'm having to suffer right now, even though this has not been released out of my life, even though I'm going through the storm right now, God, I will still have confidence in you. You're still with me. My circumstances do not mean that I've lost my confidence in you. So how do we apply this? I mean, when you're in the midst of this just junk of life, I mean, when you're in this storm that will not go away, when you're just getting hit over and over, what do you do? Let me give you three very practical things. And this is on your notes page if you want to take notes. First thing is this, when the storms won't go away, accept that sometimes God is our refuge and not our deliverer. That there are times that God says, I want you to take refuge in me, but for this period of time, you're still going to have to suffer. And that's what we see in David's life. David said, God, I'm taking refuge in you, but Saul's still out there. God, I've got confidence in you, but Saul is still after me. God, you are still present with me, but Saul is still trying to kill me. He was still going through this time of suffering. So we don't like this at all, do we? I don't like this at all. If I was writing this story would have been much different than the one we just read in 1 Samuel 24. I would have written this story in a way that just makes sense to us, that feels right, that feels fair. If I was writing this story, in fact, it would have been something like this. David and his men, they would have been in the cave, deep in the cave, and Saul would have been walking along, and then suddenly he had to go potty. So he would have gone into the cave to go potty, and David, doing everything right, above board, would have gone and cut off the corner of Saul's robe. He would not have killed him. Gone back into the cave. Then when Saul was finished, Saul left the cave. David would have come out. He would have made the same speech that he made. So far, so good in the text. I was fine with all of that. It's just that if I was writing the story, when David finished saying what he said, before Saul could have formed a word on his lips, this lightning bolt from heaven would have come down and struck Saul right where he stood. And just like in the cartoons, for a moment there would have been this black figure of ashes just kind of hanging there. And then they would have fallen to the ground in a big heap right there on the ground. And then there would have been this tension because David's men were there and Saul's soldiers, 3,000 men were there. And there would have been this tense moment. What are these soldiers going to do? And this dramatic pause in that time. And then suddenly those soldiers would have started singing, ding dong, the king is dead, the king is dead, the king is dead, ding dong, the wicked king is dead. And they would have lifted David on their shoulders and they all would have carried him to Jerusalem to be anointed the next king. And everyone would have lived happily ever after. Right? I mean, that's the story we want. That's the story that is fair. That's every modern Hollywood movie. The good guys win, the evil guys are defeated. And everyone lives happily ever after. I mean, that's how we would write the story because that's right and that's fair. Sometimes life isn't fair. right? Sometimes things happen to us, and it's not fair. And we think, God, why is this happening? And here's what David says. Here's what the Bible teaches us. There are times that we need to say, God, I'm trusting you in spite of my circumstances. And right now, you are my refuge, even if you're not my deliverer. I came across a quote this past week that was found on a wall in a prison cell in Auschwitz. And after the Allies invaded and released all the prisoners there, this is what they discovered. Someone wrote, I believe in the sun even when it is not shining. I believe in love even when I am alone. I believe in God even when He is silent. Even in the midst of tragic circumstances, God is still present, even when it is hard to see or perceive Him. It takes incredible faith to write something like that in the midst of those kinds of circumstances. That is the kind of faith that the Bible calls us to. That is what this passage calls us to. That is what the story of David calls us to do, to say to God, in spite of circumstances, I still trust in you. Second thing is this, don't try to short-circuit your suffering. This is a big lesson we learn in this passage. David very easily could have killed Saul and he would have been done with his suffering. But David said, I'm not going to do that because that's not in God's will. Even though everyone would have said, David, you are totally justified in that. I'm not going to get out of God's will just to end my suffering. There's such a temptation when we are going through some situation to try to short circuit our suffering, to get outside of God's will just to end our suffering. If you've ever read Hebrews chapter 11, you know that it is called the Hall of Fame of Faith. The writer of Hebrews goes through and lists all of these Old Testament figures and how they had incredible faith in spite of their circumstances, in spite of many times not realizing the promise that God had for them, they still had this faith. Then he gets towards the end of that passage, and he begins to write about these individuals who were suffering for their faith. We don't know who they are, but they were suffering for their faith and were willing to do so and not go around God's will to end their faith. Hebrews 11, verse 35 reads this way. There were others. We don't know who these others were. There were others who were tortured, refusing to be released so that they might gain an even better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging and even chains and imprisonment. They were put to death by stoning. They were sawed in two. They were killed by the sword. These individuals were going through incredible suffering, torture. But it says here they were refused to be released so that they may gain a better resurrection. What's implied here is they had a chance to get out of their suffering. All they had to do was to deny their faith in God. And they could have been released and they would not have faced this torture, this imprisonment, whatever it was they were facing. They said, I will not end my suffering if it means getting outside of the will of God. So often we're tempted to do that. If you've been around for a while, you know that I spent about 10 years in student ministry. And one of the churches where I served, there was a girl who came up through our ministry, super active, did all the youth group things, went on all the retreats. And then she went off to college, and during her freshman year in college, she started to date a guy who was not a Christian. And over the break, it may have been Christmas break, may have been spring break, I don't remember, she was home, and she began to talk about this with me. And said, you know, I'm dating this guy, and you know, is he a Christian? No. Does he even believe in God? I don't really think so. He's kind of unapologetically not a Christian. And I said, why in the world are you doing this? I said, you know what the Bible says? This is not good. I mean, the Bible talks about being unequally yoked. I said, you know, if you end up marrying this guy, the thing that's the most important to you will not be important to all at him, you know, to him. Why are you doing this? And she looked at me and said, because I'm tired of being alone. I'm tired of Friday nights, my roommates having dates. I'm tired of being alone. I said, be careful. Don't go around God's will just to end your suffering. As tempting as it may be, God says, stay faithful to me. I've got a better plan for you than you trying to short-circuit your suffering. Then finally, here's the last thing. We'll end with this. Pray for times of refreshing. Say something like this to God. Okay, God, if I'm going through this suffering, I get it. Right now, I'm not to be released from the suffering. I get it. But God, I need an Engedi in my life. I need a waterfall in the desert. I need some refreshment. I need this oasis during this dry period of life. God, if I have to suffer, if this is not going to end, I get that. But God, would you bring some refreshment, some times of refreshing into my life? Maybe that's in the form of a friend who comes along just at the right time, or some kind of financial release from this burden that you're going through, or maybe just one good report from the doctor, or maybe it's this relationship, and for a period of time, this difficult relationship gets a little better. Whatever it is, say, God, right now, I need an Engedi. I need just a little bit of encouragement so that I can stay faithful in following you. And you pray that prayer, and I guarantee you, God will answer it.